Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, December 12, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the book, The Political Theory of the American Founding. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Eric R. Claes, Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and Visiting Professor at Harvard Law School, and the author of the book, Professor Thomas G. West, Potter Endowed Professor in Politics at the Van Andel Graduate School of Statesmanship at Hillsdale College. After remarks from Professor West, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor West. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Laura, and thanks to Eric, too, for joining us. What we're going to do is I'm going to have Eric ask me some questions and make some his own comments, and I've heard also there will be some criticisms. To keep it livelier, I won't be giving any long disquisition, but I will say just one thing about what the point of the book is, and that is that in my career studying the founders, American founders, I've found again and again there really isn't anything to recommend to students as what do I look at to understand the political theory of the founders. And by political theory, I don't mean so much the structure of the Constitution and similar topics, but rather what did they think justice was and what did they think government should do to achieve justice insofar as that can be done here on Earth. So that's what it's about. The book has three big parts. One is the natural rights theory itself of the founders. The second is on the role of the founding principles in moral character, in the formation of moral character, something that is today not particularly well understood or even recognized. And the third part of the book is a series of chapters going into in detail laws on property and economics that were promoted in the founding, both at the federal and state level, all of which were designed, as in my argument, to secure the natural right to property, to acquire property and to possess property, which they thought, founders thought, is one of the basic jobs the government has to do. So I think what I'll ask, at this point I'll ask Eric, what do you think I should bring up next, Eric?
I think one thing I'd encourage Tom to tell readers about is that Tom wrote a book 20 years ago called Vindicating the Founders, and I'm curious, what did that book try to do, and why does the political theory of the American founding, why is it necessary after vindicating?
Right. The 20-year-ago book, Vindicating the Founders, was done as a response to what I took to be the leading critiques of the founders coming from the left. And it took a partisan stance. It was a book vindicating, that is, defending the founding fathers' point of view on a number of topics that are considered important today, on the question of race, poor people and whether they were property provided for in the founding, voting rights in particular for women. The whole question of women and the family was a chapter, and also immigration policy. The founders had a somewhat restrictive view of that. And I tried to respond to the left-wing complaints about those things. And I thought of originally doing a book to respond to continue that theme, kind of responding to the conservative critiques of the founding, of which there are many today also. Many conservatives think the whole turn to natural rights was a big mistake and has led to what conservatives think of as all of our problems today. But instead of that, I decided, I don't think people really understand the theory very well in the first place. So before vindicating, maybe I need to spend more effort just explaining. And I found that I, too, once I got into it, needed to understand better some of the things I thought I had understood when I wrote the earlier book. So I think just going into and explaining it in some depth, what did they think they were up to and what did they think government needed to do to achieve its ends? That turned out to be a big project and one I'm happy to have completed at this point.
You said a couple of times that you tried to write a resource accessible to students to make clear to them the principles of the founding or the principles of the Declaration of Independence. So let's try out some of the lessons from the book. How would you explain to a college student or grad student what a natural right is as understood by the founders?
The founders thought of rights, natural rights, in light of a concept they called state of nature. And by that they meant that the natural condition that human beings are in is a state of freedom. No one has, and is in that state, no human being is ruling another human being except by consent, by contract. And now, what they didn't literally mean that people in some place in history were spending a lot of time together without any form of government whatsoever. It was what they meant was, though, if you think about what's nature, what is human nature just given to us from nature alone, it means that politics is something that's socially constructed. It's artificial. That was the concept of the state of nature. It means that, strictly speaking, we're not part of a political order except due to convention, due to imposition from outside. And so what makes a political order legitimate is consent. And what makes human relationships legitimate is consent. So they thought of liberty basically as the fundamental right that exists by nature, and that government is there to protect as much as it can do that consistently with the needs of a political order. So all the other natural rights that the founders talked about can be seen to be aspects of the right to liberty. So, for example, life. Obviously, you can't exercise your freedom if someone has you can't be free if someone can take away your life at his whim and not yours. You can't. And then property. If you are free, you should be able to acquire things through your effort and through trading with others or being given gifts. Similarly, other kinds of natural rights, like religious freedom. If you're born free, you are obviously free to worship in whatever way you choose. If you're born free, you have the right to freedom of speech, freedom to publish your views to other people. So all of the rights, all the natural rights, have that basic character. They're originally aspects of or implications of the basic natural right to liberty, which all men are equal in having that original right. So that's what they meant by equality too. Equality meant equal liberty. So, for example, in many of the founding era documents, like various state constitutions, the phrase would be something like, "All men are born equally free and independent." Meaning that equality meant only that you have the same liberty as anyone else. Equality in the founding never meant that you have the right to health care or to be taken care of by others and so on. It meant you are free of other people's coercive control over you.
I want to jump in there. You had mentioned the part three of the books about the founders' general views on property and freedom of contract and economics. Can you give an example of the kinds of things a government was supposed to do to secure rights and the kinds of things that a government should try to avoid doing to avoid interfering with rights, especially when dealing with property, with markets?
Yes, their idea of property was that you not only have the right to possess property, that is the property you already have, but you also have the right to acquire property, and that meant that government has a positive role to play in establishing the conditions by which individuals who don't have property can get it. And in the founding, that meant basically establishing free markets. So, and what it takes to have a free market is three big things, which have to be done, in their view, by government. Could be done voluntarily, but mostly doesn't work voluntarily. One is the definition of property. How do you know who owns what? In a state of nature, the only way you would know that if somebody's occupying a piece of property with a fence around it. But of course, there are many kinds of property in society that can't be where you don't have physically or not physically there at that moment, every part of the day. And similarly, you have to define the use of property. And so in what way can you use property such that it doesn't harm others? So they had the idea of tort laws was built into the notion of property, the right to possess property and to use property. The second kind of thing government has to do is to pay attention to markets. What does it take to create markets? The most important thing in regard to that point is freedom of contract. There have to be the opportunity for people to make contracts and then to go to court when contracts are violated. In a state outside of civil society, in a state of nature, contracts can exist, but there's no enforcement mechanism other than simply the individual who claims to have been cheated. But in order for a contract to be likely to be looked up to and enforced and respected, it needs the help of others. And that's what contract law was for, in their view. And then third, there needs to be some sort of monetary means of exchange, something like money, which, again, can be something that's natural, but the founders thought it was important for government to create a regular means of exchange, money, which cannot be easily manipulated and weakened by government, so they thought paper money was not a good idea, and they very much favored, in fact, explicitly in the Constitution, gold and silver coin were supposed to be the only legal tender permit that the states were permitted to establish. So those kinds of things, these things often tend to be misunderstood today. The idea of freedom of market entry, for example, is very much interfered with today by the regulatory state. What people often don't understand is the regulatory state is often something that big businesses like because they have legal teams that have figured out a way to accommodate themselves to it. But it's a huge barrier for a newcomer to the market who doesn't have a lot of money and capital. But in our situation, it's very hard to get through all of that, figure out what all the things you have to do before you can even open your business. So those are just that's one example of many of the many ways in which things have become quite different in our current world.
I skipped over part two of your book. You mentioned that there's the middle section of the book is about the way in which principles of natural rights justify government efforts to look over and enforce public morals. And I think for a lot of listeners, that jump might seem surprising. So I want to go through a few different examples. And I want to start with, let's say the government passes a law that makes it hard for people to get divorced. I think a lot of people today would say that a law like that seems unfair because it restrains people's freedom. And how can a set of principles that are grounded in freedom lead to a family law that makes it hard to get divorced?
Right. Well, the reason why the founders were unanimously agreed that the moral character of the citizens is important for a society is because they didn't think you could have a free society unless the citizens were, by and large, willing to behave in a more or less decent manner. Now, they didn't expect perfection, obviously, and they knew people misbehave all the time. But they did think that there are certain minimal things that government needs to step in and promote in order to sustain a society that's going to truly protect freedom. So they thought of morality as something that is supportive of freedom. And in the case of family law, they thought of stable families as one of the most important ways to protect individual freedom. Now, I think we today, as you suggested, Eric, are much more skeptical of that because we would say, well, wait, you might not have the right to instant divorce. But the way the founders looked at that was that marriage as an institution was an institution from the point of view of society to produce and raise children. And so, because somebody's got to do it, and who has better or more of a self-interest in providing for and taking care of children than their biological married parents? That was their argument, right or wrong. I mean, today people would dispute that. But they thought that's the best deal both for children and for men and women as a whole. So they, the idea of divorce, it was understood in light of the notion that, that marriage is a contract which has certain terms that if they're violated by one party or the other can then be abrogated, just like any contract where one side is not keeping up its side of the bargain. So they thought of marriage that way. So each the husband and wife both have certain duties to the marriage. For example, not cheat on the other person. And you could get the contract, you can go to court and have the contract canceled in the case of adultery. And that, so they thought of that, but you couldn't go to court and have the contract canceled just because you said, well, I'm not really sure I like this relationship anymore. That's the one thing they didn't allow, because as long as the relationship was doing its job that as they saw it as necessary for the good of society as well as the good of the children and the other adult in the relationship, then it should be sustained.
I want to take another example in the same spirit. In the last, I don't know, 5 years or decade, there's been a lot of debates in a lot of different countries about immigration. And the Brexit vote, was in some part an expression by majority of the British people. They were concerned about not being able to control immigration from the rest of the European Union into England. And immigration was an important issue that helped get President Trump the presidency.
Right.
But it's kind of strange to think of it, or from what, if depending on how you understand ideas of natural rights, it might be strange or unjust for a country to exclude some foreigners and include others. I mean, everybody is equal. Everybody in the world is equal. Everybody deserves equal opportunity to make himself better. Why should a government pick and choose the foreigners it wants to let in?
Yeah, that's right. And that's the question you raise, of course, is the question being raised by, I'd say, the majority of educated people against Trump and his attempt to change these policies. But the way the founders thought of immigration was in terms of the what they called the social compact. Their idea was since all men are created equal with respect to the right to liberty, the only way a government can be rightly established is if it's agreed to by the people who form that government. And furthermore, the only way a government can become legitimate over those who were born after the government is established is if the people who make that choice if the people who want to become citizens agree to become citizens, and if the citizens themselves agree to accept those citizens. Their idea was citizenship has to be based on mutual consent on both on the side of those who are already citizens and on the side of the person that wants to be a citizen. They viewed, therefore, immigration policy, just as all other policies, in terms of national sovereignty. Any policy dealing with other people who are not citizens fell under the category of, well, you know, you're not part of our nation, but you do have your rights. We will not violate your rights, but you don't have any citizen rights, such as the right to live here or the right to become part of our society, unless we consent to it. So the idea of consent was considered fundamental to citizenship and therefore also to immigration and naturalization policy. But in addition to that, the founders had one other thing in mind, which is not only do you have the right as a nation to say no to immigration of whatever kind you want to not have, you also have a duty to concern yourself with the suitability of potential immigrants to become good citizens of a free society. And the founders had very strong views about that, about who are likely to be good citizens of our country and good future citizens of our country. There were debates in the founding, for example, about how much European immigration should we have. We're not so sure that it's such a good thing to have. And they were concerned about it taking place too rapidly at some points. So this is a topic that goes all the way back to the beginning and is viewed entirely in terms of what they regarded as the basic right to liberty of every individual and then liberty exercised by a society, the liberty to decide who it wants to associate with and make fellow citizens.
There are a couple of passages in the book about foreign policy. Not a lot, given the overview you gave of the three main parts of the book, but like in Chapter 10, you talk about the general implications of natural rights principles for foreign policy. Why don't you say a little bit about those principles?
Yeah, if I had wanted to make the book even bigger, I would have had a chapter on this, but foreign policy in the founding was understood, like everything else, in terms of their basic natural rights theory. And their idea was that there are two basic principles that guide foreign policy. And both of them happen to be stated at the beginning of the Declaration of Independence. One of them is the obvious point: government must secure these rights, by which it means secure the rights of our citizens. And one of the ways it does that, the most urgent way, is to protect citizens against possible violence from other nations. And so defense, national defense, is from that point of view the fundamental purpose and indeed the sole purpose of foreign policy. Because remember, the founders' view was the government is entirely accountable to its own citizens and is not accountable to anyone else because no one else consented to be governed by that government. So we didn't have, in their view, there was no American right to impose its way of life on other nations or to go into other nations and correct things that are, judged from our point of view, going wrong in those places. The other point of, and that leads to the second point of view that they adopted to guide foreign policy, stated in the first sentence of the Declaration, which is that all nations have a right to a, quote, separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, unquote. So in other words, every nation has the right to be left alone by other nations, a separate and equal station. So taking these two principles together, government's job in foreign policy is first, secure the citizens' rights to life, liberty, and property by national defense, and second, refrain from interfering in other nations because of this natural law obligation to respect each nation's right, each nation's individual right to liberty, which is then collectively a right to a separate and equal station among the nations of the earth. And so, this is a view of foreign policy that is considered today to be libertarian or isolationist or something, and probably most people, both liberal and conservative, would reject it. I should add, though, that the founders did not rule out the idea of alliances with other nations. Obviously, the American Revolution was won in part because of a successful alliance with France. They also didn't rule out the idea of intervening in other nations when it comes to national defense. And so, although in principle the other nations are to be left alone, they believed it was important to keep an eye on other nations as potential or actual threats and to make alliances or be involved militarily with them if need be in other respects.
I'm going to ask a short question and flesh it out a little bit. The short question is, why does this political history matter? And the longer version goes something like this. The book's making a descriptive claim. It's presenting an intellectual history of what the founders thought on foundations and what main policy principles they drew from those foundations. But the book's not saying that any contemporary policy right now is wrong. It's more trying to explain what the founders thought. And it marks differences between what the founders thought and what we do now, but it doesn't say that anything that anybody does now is wrong. So why should we care about what the founders thought on any of these topics?
Well, on the big picture question, why should we care what the founders thought about anything? They are the people who kicked off the United States of America, started the nation. Now, of course, there were lots of people who did this, you know, who were involved in colonial times, and things have changed since then. But what happened early on turned out to be really important and influential in later developments, particularly throughout the 19th century. With the exception of the problem of slavery in the 19th century South, the nation as a whole was pretty much on board with the way of thinking about politics that was articulated in the founding. And that didn't really start to become powerfully challenged until the 1880s and 90s, beginning in that period. Prior to that time, it was really a surprising degree of consensus among Americans, and equally there was a surprising consensus in the founding among the leading founders about the basic purposes of government and the basic policies that government needs to achieve those purposes. That's something that's not well understood today, but which might turn out to be something we should try to learn about. They were pretty successful in what they did, and that was a time in America, arguably, in which freedom was better protected than it has been in the various periods of the 20th century and 21st century, where we've gotten away to a large degree from those principles. So although the book's not judgmental about that, it does raise the question, well, you know, reader, take a look. This is how they understood it. Do you think that's better or not as good as what we're doing now? So that's what I was trying to achieve there. The judgmental, you know, the basic way I understand the way justice is understood today in America is I like to use the word Rawlsian. I don't believe that that politicians study Rawls. It's just way too boring for that. But they do have a basically Rawlsian orientation towards justice, and I mean by that a couple of things. One is, the Rawls view of justice was people should be allowed to do whatever they want, especially in regard to sex. And so that would explain why, for example, people's conception of marriage has changed so dramatically since the 1960s, when it was still thought to be an institution in which there should not be no-fault divorce. And then secondly, the Rawlsian orientation is in favor of making people as equal as possible in regard to their access to resources. And that would mean money, but especially would also mean honor. Having the right to be honored and respected has become a fundamental theme in our politics today. And meaning honored and respected no matter what your way of life might be. So a way of life or a choice of a series of choices that the founders would have called irresponsible or lacking in virtue, in the new orientation, people are supposed to not say anything about, not be judgmental in that way about things. And the third aspect of Rawlsianism is the promotion of inequality insofar as inequality is believed by people today to promote the good of the least among us. And so, for example, people believe that it's fine for members of non-governmental organizations, of politicians to receive huge amounts of honor, wealth, privilege, because they're the virtuous ones among us. They're the ones who are dedicating their lives supposedly to serving those who are disadvantaged and making sure and standing up for the principle of liberty, in the modern sense of liberty, of protecting all of the sexual freedoms that we value so much in our society today. And all of that, I mean, the founders would have said, well, you know, some of that makes some sense, but mostly they would have thought, no, liberty doesn't include the right to do things that are going to be harmful to children. Giving, for example, having children without being married, it's not likely to be a good thing for them. They didn't think that the right to be treated fairly required that people not criticize you when you misbehave. They thought it was important for people to sustain a moral climate in which liberty was understood as responsible liberty. And third, I don't think they would have agreed that the kind of inequality we see today, which is becoming more and more substantial, is consistent with a free society, especially since so much of the inequality we now see is coming from connections with government and government favors and government government funding.
Laura, I think I'm going to ask one more question, and then we can take things to questions from the audience. And the last question is, what do you think, Tom, lawyers might get from reading your book?
Well, I'll just give an example. One of the points that I discussed in the book is when I first went into an overview of how does government secure our natural rights, I spent some time there on the idea of criminal and civil law, and especially civil and criminal laws that are meant to protect people against injury. Criminal law. Jefferson has a nice formulation for that. He says that wicked and dissolute men commit violations on the lives, liberty, and property of others, and government would be defective if it were not to restrain such criminal acts by punishments. So its principal purpose, he's saying, or Jefferson's saying, is to restrain those criminal acts of harm to life, liberty, and property. And so, you know, if you think about our society today, we have a very different view of that. We have, for a recent study that came out of Houston, for example, in 2013, there were 20,000 burglary, theft, assault, and hit-and-run cases with workable leads that were not investigated at all by the police. We have, in the case of Detroit and Memphis, huge backlogs of rape evidence kits, women raped, women where the kits were taken. Evidence of rape was in those kits, but then no one investigated them. In the case of Detroit, 11,000 abandoned rape kits were discovered in a police warehouse at one point. And similarly, in Memphis, Tennessee, in 2014, 12,000 untested rape kits. This is what we have today is a government that is not serious about what the founders thought the main thing government is supposed to do is, and that's to enforce criminal law. And what we have today, of course, are very different priorities. And our priorities go to much more to things like funding education or funding specific programs that help people in need, medical care, things like that, and of course policies that are meant to target the needy, and which we spend a lot of our effort on that. And so the founders' idea was government should serve not just the needy, it should serve everybody, it should serve the common good. And so if you have property stolen, or if you have your car stolen or burgled, or if you're assaulted, their view was that's a right being violated. That's a natural right being violated. And government should put a lot of effort into tracking down, prosecuting, and punishing those kinds of things. In our society today, the government is only it's a thing. Of course, we still do that, but it seems to be regarded very much as a secondary or tertiary concern. And so what's happened to criminal law? And the same thing is true in civil law too, where injuries to reputation. People being vilified in court, people being harmed, even in regard to, there are many cases where people are not allowed to see their own children because they've been accused of abuse, and then there's no trial, there's no ability for the person to defend himself or herself. So we have a lot of this that goes on. It seems like what we've lost sight of from the point of view of the older understanding is that the basic job of government, which is just protection, has been sidelined. And it's happened without us really even noticing it, seems to me, to a large extent.
Okay, Laura, thanks a lot, Tom. And Laura, I think now's a good time for members of the audience to ask questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
Yes, thanks. This is Mike Doherty in Atlanta. You know, I'm in a lot of litigation right now, and one thing that we've noticed, and I'm a defendant and a plaintiff, I'm not a lawyer, it's a battle with the Federal Trade Commission that has involved state and federal courts in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Washington. And I have to say one of the sad observations we've had is that the judiciary is more concerned about clean docket and workload than they are with justice. And lawyers are more concerned about what the background is on the judge and how to position than the actual justice. And this is a very systemic issue where even we've had a ruling on fraud on the court that is in direct conflict of Hazel Atlas, and the lack of outrage is really concerning. And I don't know if you can speak to that, because I think it has penetrated the judiciary in a lot of ways, and I'm sitting at the 50-yard line observing this to the cost of millions of dollars out of my money and a lot of pro bono law firms have been involved, and it's quite disheartening as to what to do about it.
Yeah, I think this is what this is an example of what I think has happened, is that these regulatory commissions, of course, like the FTC, were set up to help make government to make business practices more in conformity with what's in the interest of the consumer. And what's happened, unfortunately, is that for various reasons, these agencies aren't really functioning that way. And the same with the judiciary. The judiciary was originally set up to adjudicate cases between people who had a claim, conflicting claims about what their legal rights were. And that has gotten lost too, as you say, especially in the concern with keeping the cases moving, keeping the docket clear. But why is that? My point, it's one of the points I was making, is in a world like that of the founders, that would have immediately been thought of as this is a reason why we need to beef up the judiciary. We need to make sure there's plenty of judges so that courts are open all the time to people, and so that they can give due appropriate attention to the cases that are out there and that need to be adjudicated, not in a quick way, but in a fair way. And fraud, you know, that's something you mentioned fraud. That's something that the courts used to think that was an important thing. That's an important violation of contract. And so, yeah, that's, I agree with you. And so, I think the basic problem, if the mentality of the people and of the business world and of everybody is such that protecting people has been lost sight of. That, to me, is what I was saying. The big theme of the founding was the government's there to protect you. And we've got this other idea. The government's there to make all these things right for you, to solve social problems, as opposed to the basic role of protection, which is a relatively easy, but not all that easy, thing for it to do.
Eric, would you like to comment on this question?
No comment.
All right, let's go to our next audience caller.
Dr. West, this is Jack Painter in Cincinnati. I read your book and very much enjoyed it. I have a question about a point you made on one of the justifications for natural rights. One of the justifications is that they are instrumental. They're necessary for the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
If we define happiness as Aristotle did, as well-being through well-doing, and say we achieve it by practicing virtue, then the question is, why is liberty a necessary condition to practicing virtue, a condition to living well? And by practicing virtue, I'm talking about, I believe, using reason to identify proper ends and necessary means, and then actually choosing to pursue those ends using those means.
Right. So, because your question implies that if government is there to help to promote human happiness, which the founders definitely did believe it was supposed to do, then maybe government should take more of a direct role in helping people become happy, in the sense of behaving in a way that's going to lead them to their own well-being, in the way that thinkers like Aristotle or Plato are thought to have believed. And so I talked about this some in towards the end of the book. The founders were aware there are different ways of promoting happiness, and they did know of the idea that government should take an active role in making you happy by telling you how you should live your life and not giving you liberty. But they believed that experience of that, and especially during the medieval period, had proved that was a bad idea, not because government shouldn't concern itself with happiness, but because when government does concern itself, it's likely to get it wrong. It's likely to impose something on people that's based on some prejudice or superstition or more likely just interest. And so why not? Their idea was, well, let's have liberty, as much liberty as possible. They didn't believe you could have absolute liberty in the way that, in the sense, say, that Justice Kennedy thinks that every citizen should have the right to define the meaning of the universe, but they did believe that you should have the right to, you should have liberty in the context of minimal moral rules that enable people to live together in relative peace and civility. And so that was their way of thinking of trying to negotiate the difference between a, let's say, a Platonic idea of government's going to shove morality down your throat, or the medieval, versus the libertarian ideal, where government simply backs off and lets people behave in any way they want to.
Tom, I have a go ahead.
Just to ask a follow-up question, to put it in a concrete example, I in the United States have liberty, and the argument is that I am therefore better able to practice virtue and pursue happiness than, let's say, someone in former East Germany who didn't have liberty. And why would they say that is tied to life, liberty, and freedom of contract, or life, property, and freedom of contract? I'm struggling with it, because it just seems to me that if virtue is choosing the right ends and pursuing the right means and actually making the choice, why does it matter whether you live in a totalitarian state? I think it does matter, but I'm trying to better understand why it matters that you have liberty, negative rights.
Well, liberty in the sense of the right to live as you please is the only form of government that is compatible with the basic idea of your natural right to be free. I mean, the founders thought part of what it takes for you to be happy is for you to not be pushed around by other people. Mostly, and of course, being pushed around by other people often and usually means people who don't have your own best interest at heart. The problem with a society like East Germany, the former East Germany, is the government thought, we know what's good for you. Marxism. And the coming of the revolution, which means temporarily you need to shut up and not own any private property and not have freedom of speech and freedom of education. And the founders would have said, yep, that's what happens. That's what happens when government tries to solve that problem for people. So if you don't have freedom, you're not going to have virtue typically. You can imagine a situation where you might have a perfectly ideal society. That's what Aristotle does say at the end of his Politics. But that's not going to happen as a practical matter. And so, of course, liberty in the sense of the founders, kind of measured or moderate liberty, liberty under natural law, that's they thought that was the best deal you're likely to get in this world.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go to our next audience question.
You have.
In the summary of your book, Protestant thinking is identified as one of the bodies of thought that influenced the founders. I wonder if you could just expand up on that a little bit. Are you talking about religious liberty or other concerns?
Well, of course, most people at the time of the founding in America were Protestants. Many of the founders themselves, individual founders, were probably non-believers, although most of them were respectful of and practiced Christianity in usually Protestant form. And it was part of the colonial heritage that was there. At one point in my book, I talk about the idea that the founding is a product of a coalescence of different conflicting traditions. The natural rights tradition, which in some people's mind means that you don't care about morality, and then the Christian Protestant tradition, which means, if you take that view, that you have to have the right morality and also the right belief. And what I was saying about that, what I think the founders did about that is they thought that the natural rights and natural law theory is the lens through which everything has to be understood. So, yes, we have this Protestant tradition. It's there. We should make use of it. We should support it as long as it continues to be supportive of natural law and natural rights. So, for example, in some colonies, they required you to get a permit in order to be a preacher, to be able to preach a sermon. You had to get a permit from the state because they only wanted one kind of Christianity in some states. This was the case in Virginia and Connecticut, among others. And the founders thought, no, that's a violation of religious liberty. So if, insofar as that's what you mean by Protestantism, they said, no, we're not going to have that. However, on the other hand, it turns out, if you look at the course of Protestant thought in America prior to the American Revolution, and this goes all the way back to the 1620s and 30s, what you find is that the Americans' own self-understanding of Protestantism evolved and changed during that period. And it's an interesting story. I didn't tell it in my book, but the story of how American Protestants became much more sympathetic to the idea of religious liberty and freedom of religion than they would have been in 1620, when of course there wasn't any religious liberty in America at that time. And so in that sense, yes, they were influenced by Protestantism, but Protestantism itself had already adopted, by the time of the founding, many of the same ideas about government and justice that became incorporated into the official documents. The typical Protestant sermon of the time of the founding was saying things like, Christianity is supportive of the right to life, liberty, and property, and so is human reason in the form of natural law. And isn't it great that human reason and divine revelation have a basic agreement on this fundamental question of justice and of what government should do. So that's the way in which this topic was understood at the time, and I think it's often misunderstood today because people today are not accustomed to think of Protestant theologians as being interested in the question of natural law and natural rights, but they certainly were back then.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Hi, Tom, Eric. It's Ken Masugi. I'd just like to say that having read Tom's book, anyone who appeals to originalism or other such founding era arguments really needs to read Tom's book before they do anything serious in that vein. Now, my question was actually touched on by the previous callers, and what I was wondering was how does reason get into the state of nature in the first place? In other words, is it something that people in civilized countries who came up with the idea of the state of nature, is it something that they see in it, or does it actually develop from, say, observing the law of nature within the state of nature?
Well, look, I don't want to make this overly complicated. I think the founders had a common sense view of the matter, which is that one of the things human beings are born with is the capacity to think clearly and to observe reality and draw conclusions from their observations. That's what they meant by reason. And so, yes, of course they thought there was reason in the state of nature. People have their minds. That's something that's a natural gift. And it's a question of do you use your reason? How well do you use it? How well do you exercise it? Now, the founders themselves would also have added that, of course, if you're living in a state of nature that's an uncivilized state of nature, and one of their examples was Indians, then you will probably not understand natural right and natural law, because your mind will be distorted by superstition. But they also believed that any human being, including the Indians, blacks, anybody, has the capacity to think. And it's a question of how well is your reason developed? And so they thought, well, we've figured these things out. We've learned to some degree from European philosophers, but we've also learned from our own observations that these principles are right and good, and we have reasons for thinking that. It wasn't just that they weren't simply adopted because somebody in Europe said that they were true. So reason is something that's there. It's something that can be acquired, and it's something that we can exercise. And, of course, it's true in civilized societies. You're more likely to find a fuller development of it. But in principle, it's in the human condition, and it's part of the equipment we're given by nature to help us think about what is it in life that we should do, and how should we organize our social and political affairs. I don't know if that helps or not.
Yeah, no, that's really very good. And what I was thinking of is people like, say, Patrick Deneen, who criticized the Declaration because it, in their view, leads to an undermining of teleology. Make the argument, I suppose, that that the passions drive reason, and that therefore the notion of reason in the founding era is very attenuated and doesn't reach the Aristotelian heights.
You know, look, Patrick Deneen and I, we debated this question not too long ago in D.C. at a panel I was on. He flat out does not understand the founding. I mean, he's a nice man. He's a widely recognized scholar, but he doesn't know what he's talking about, with all due respect, because he thinks that what the founders meant by liberty is you can do whatever you want. And that absolutely, the founders over and over said, that's not what we mean by liberty. They said, what we mean by liberty is liberty as long as you follow the basic requirements of the law of nature, which is you've got to behave yourself, you've got to act in a responsible way towards others and also towards yourself. And so the idea of this unlimited liberty that Patrick Deneen worries about, that he believes to be present in our current society, which I also think he's wrong about. Our society is not full of liberty at all anymore. It's all kinds of restraints that are imposed. Political correctness is stifling. But Deneen seems to think we live in a regime of total liberty today, and it's all due to the founder's view of belief in total liberty. He's just wrong on both sides. He doesn't understand our current situation. He doesn't understand the founding. Now, he's got an argument for it. He says, well, I read in some writing by somebody or other, maybe Leo Strauss, that the founders read Locke and Locke read Hobbes, and Hobbes, we all know, is a bad guy, and therefore we should say that the founders don't understand anything in the proper Aristotelian manner. One of the things I did in my book was to say, let's get away from that kind of talk. Let's stop speculating about who the founders read and what their influences were and what European writer thought this or thought that. Look at what they say. Every one of the founders believed in teleology, if you want to use that term, that barbaric term. They believed in teleology in the sense they, of course, believed human life has a purpose. The purpose of life is happiness, and there are reasonable and unreasonable ways you can pursue that path to happiness. And they thought government should have at least some minimal role in helping people pursue happiness in a sensible way by providing them with liberty, but also teaching them through the law what are their basic minimal rights and duties towards themselves and towards others. So maybe I don't appreciate the concern of people like Deneen as much as I should, but I honestly wish they would start with giving a more accurate account of what the founders themselves said and thought before they proceed to denounce philosophy and theory as a danger to modern America.
We have two more callers pending. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. Thank you for an excellent presentation. I'm eager to look at the book.
Thanks.
My question sort of overlaps in a way, but it's much broader than some of the earlier ones. To what extent did the founders' natural law theory and natural rights theory depend on or presuppose the philosophical anthropology that was synthesized by Christian orthodoxy in the previous, 1800 years?
Well, that's a question I talked about earlier, but I'll just repeat what I said very quickly, and that is that many of the founders were Protestants. Many of them were not Protestants. They were non-believers, deists perhaps of some kind or another, say someone like Franklin. But what they all agreed on, what all the founders agreed on, was that human reason is able to guide us to some extent towards what it is we should do as human beings to live well. And especially, what do we need to do to live well in the context of social and political society? So whether you were a Protestant or not a Protestant, in the founding era, you were going to have that same view, more or less, that everyone else had. Now, the difference would have been that the Protestants would say, yes, but that's not enough for salvation. What you also need is faith in Christ, faith in God, and worship, and whatever other qualities are required by the Christian faith that are not specifically required by human reason or natural law or natural rights. But the basic point of government is the government was supposed to stay out of that dispute. That was one of the main themes of the founding was government should get out of the business of trying to solve the question of what is the true religion. Let's be supportive of the Christianity we have. That was their view. But let's not support it in the sense of telling people it's wrong to be some other kind of view, but let's just say we think this is a sensible and a good way to think about things. So, yes, they agreed. The founders did believe that what you're calling Christian anthropology is something that's very much compatible with their understanding of reality, and they thought government should be respectful of that and build on that. But they didn't think of it as Christian anthropology. They thought of it as the understanding of man that comes from a proper understanding and deployment of human reason, which they thought was very largely coincident with and overlapping the teachings of Scripture and of Protestantism.
Let's go to our last audience question.
Hello, Professor List. Mary Maxwell here. I hadn't realized that the founders were so Rawlsy. And I mean, you know, you stand behind the veil of ignorance. You don't know what position you'll have in society. So it's in your interest to opt for equality. But in those days, not Rawls's days, but founders' days, one could probably grow one's own food or even draw well water out of the well. But today, when I turn on the tap in my kitchen, that's how I get H2O like magic. And I really don't know who even provides the water or who owns it these days. It's all very complicated.
Right.
So where is my natural freedom if everything is so, you know, complex and controlled? I can't just do what I want.
Well, I think you're right. It's in our society today, it's a lot harder to... It would be a lot harder than it was then to create a regime protecting private liberty to the extent they were able to do it back in those days when it was easier to see, as you point out, who owns what. But it is still true, though, in our property law, we know who owns the water. There are very strict legal rules, in fact, all over America about who owns water supplies and how those water supplies are to be allocated and under what principles and at what cost. So we do that. Now, what we've done, though, is we've gotten rid of the idea of a free market in water. I mean, that's one of the differences, is that you can't find a company that will provide water except in tiny amounts that isn't, in fact, controlled and dictated from the top down. And so, to some degree, we've taken what used to be privately owned things well, of course, water didn't used to be a matter of what we have now and publicly owned. But we've done a lot of socialization of private property in the name of making things better for consumers. Sometimes it probably does make things better, and sometimes it doesn't. So I think you're right. I'd say the biggest problem in America today for liberty is that government doesn't really respect private liberty as much as it once did. We used to have this idea that freedom meant freedom of association. You can hang out with who you like. You can hire and fire who you like. You want to start a business with people who are your friends? You don't have to meet quotas. You don't have to hire this many women or minorities. You just do what you want. And we've decided today that's injurious to people who are less advantaged, and so government isn't going to permit people to have that kind of private freedom. We see that up and down the line throughout our government and throughout our society. I think that's become a big problem that our country is going to have to face at some point, but is right now is probably not really noticing as much as it could.
Would either of you like to make some final remarks?
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, Laura, and I thank the Federalist Society. Thank Eric for putting this thing on. I very much appreciate the the opportunity to talk about my new book, The Political Theory of the American Founding. And I appreciate Eric's helpful remarks and raising some of the questions that are appropriate to raise about it. So I appreciate the forum.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. Our next teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 13th at 12 noon, and that call will be a Regulatory Transparency Project teleforum on exploring net neutrality and the implications of repeal. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.